Welcome to Thinking Aloud, a podcast about the nexus of politics and all those things that make us human from the Lindenwood University College of Arts and Humanities. I'm your host, Don Heidenreich.
The 21st century has shown itself full of foreign policy challenges. Terrorism, the growth of China, the revival of Russia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Venezuela, global pandemics have all led to shifts and changes, creating a world different from the one that our leaders grew up in the latter half of the 20th century. What might be done to solve or manage many of these world issues, and what might be coming next? In order to consider these issues, I have two guests today. My guests are Dr. Brian Arndt and Dr. Dale Walton of the Lindenwood University International Relations Program. Dr. Arndt is an expert on Asia and naval matters, and Dr. Walton is an expert on foreign policy and global strategies. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
Which issues do you see as the most significant that Americans may not be paying attention to? Dr. Walton?
One thing that I would note is that you have a civil war in Ethiopia that is receiving very little attention, yet is a terrible conflict that has seen massive crimes against humanity. And made all the worse is the fact that the president of Ethiopia won the Nobel Peace Prize a couple of years ago and then proceeded to launch the invasion of the Tigray region with all that ensued thereafter. And that story has just received almost no attention in the U.S.
Dr. Arndt?
Well, I'm going to go with Myanmar. Now, Myanmar is on the radar. It's been covered. When the Myanmar government was persecuting and really committing a crime of ethnic cleansing a few years ago, but then of course it faded out of the consciousness of the American public, but it's still ongoing. That's one of the things about some of these stories is that they don't continue once the attention is no longer paid to them. And of course we just recently had a coup attempt which succeeded. The Myanmar government set up a junta government, that is to say a government run by the military of Myanmar, and great attention paid for it, and now once again little attention is being paid for it. The Southeast Asian neighbors are very much concerned about this. Myanmar is part of an organization called ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Well, what is ASEAN? Is it a collection of democracies or not? Now, a lot of other countries in ASEAN have gone forth and created at least reasonably functioning democracies. Myanmar has been out there on the burner, and it's not as unimportant as it might seem, because its ethnic conflict can spread from there. Thailand has a problem and issues similar to that, as does Malaysia. So does Indonesia and the Philippines. Well, what's the consequence of a successful coup? And it's not nice to put it this way, a successful cleansing. What can the international community to deal with not only this type of problem, but any other humanitarian crisis around the globe?
Yeah, I would also note that there is, at this point, not a lot of attention being paid outside of the financial press to really where the global system is at in terms of looking at it in a serious way, not just looking at where the stock market is today or yesterday or whatever, but actually considering how do we move forward in a post-COVID world. And that story at the true macro level, at the global level, there isn't a lot of clarity there.
Interesting. What about the working relationship between states such as Saudi Arabia and Israel? Is that something that we should be paying attention to?
I would say that it was a major breakthrough. At this point, I'm not sure how much role the Americans are going to have in the greater Middle East in the next coming years. On the heels of the debacles in Iraq and Afghanistan, I'm just not sure that the Americans are really going to be as central in the Middle East as they have been for decades, ever since the early Cold War.
So who might supplant the United States in that respect?
Well, I'm going to guess two major powers, China and also Russia. We, you know, in the news, there's a little bit about the Russians intervening in the Syrian civil war, and we had some missile exchanges there. But what about Russia? Russia's interests in the Middle East go back a long time, all the way up to before the First World War, the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. China. China is not obviously a border power, nor does it have a lot of troops on the ground. But it has been economically interested in Saudi Arabia, we just mentioned. Saudi Arabia's trade with China has blossomed. The Chinese have invested heavily in the development oil, and the Chinese desperately need that oil because their economy is so oil-dependent, and China lacks any form of petroleum. So in the future, those two countries, I'd like to suggest, are going to play a bigger role, Russia and China.
Is there logic internal to the Middle East that might be driving the choices of places like Saudi Arabia to develop relationships, even if they're not formal relationships with Israel?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think that what happened with the breakthrough between the Saudi Arabia and Israel, as well as other powers in the Gulf, really had a lot to do with the Obama administration and what followed. The Obama administration's decision to seek the Iran nuclear deal seriously alienated a lot of Saudis at the top of the regime. And their trust in the United States, which was always very incomplete for all sorts of different reasons, as the U.S. trust in Saudi Arabia is very incomplete, that really sort of small opening, or relatively small opening, really kind of came to fruition during the Trump administration for a variety of geopolitical reasons. And now with the American defeat in Afghanistan, I would be very surprised if the United States has the desire or the ability to play the same kind of role in the Middle East that it did, you know, early 21st century, late 20th century.
Dr. Hart, you mentioned that China and Russia might very well supplant the United States. Would this impact the U.S. relationship with Israel, possibly?
That's an interesting question. If Russia continues to support, let's say, the triumphant Syrian government, in that sense, if China is spending a lot more money in countries like Saudi Arabia, and the United States is competing, let's say, for the Saudi Arabians' interest, that does place a little bit of a tricky situation. As far as I know, Israel has trade with China. I'm not an expert on, I have to admit, that's a little bit out of my league, but that would be interesting, a three-pronged interest in the Middle East, similar to what happened to the Ottoman Empire when it collapsed after World War I, where you had the British, the French, and actually the Russians competing to carve up the Ottoman Empire. So are we going to see something not that serious, but maybe a carving up of the resources?
One thing that I think we will see is a different attitude to this competition, in that I don't think either Russia or China really, at this point at least, want a large permanent presence in the Middle East. China and Russia too want to have influence, but I think that having seen the disastrous, I mean, I'm willing to say that I think the American empire is dying. And it destroyed itself on the rocks of Iraq and Afghanistan more than any place else. And I don't think that the Chinese and the Russians want to repeat what they probably rightly perceive as the American mistake.
Of course, the Russians may very well go back with Afghanistan and say, we had our experience there too. It's not completely they didn't make an effort at it.
Yeah, but they didn't spend 20 years or nearly as much money as we did.
That's true.
And they were somewhat more direct in many respects.
Yeah,
that is important. So what other issues? One thing that strikes me as interesting, both with China and Europe, but also with the United States and Europe, with changes that are going on there, how might both of these powers be influenced or influence what's happening as Europe sees itself changing?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I'm almost going to suggest that one of the big changes in Europe that affects foreign policy is the stepping down of Angela Merkel and the coming elections in Germany. Mm. Because her party pursued a very definite policy of, well, we might criticize China, but we're going to continue to increase trade with China. We're going to increase investment. Angela Merkel's government actually, as something I read earlier, actually went on a sort of a trade mission to China, bringing along its top business leaders. So this is an interesting possible turning point, because I think most analysts would suggest that Germany is the strongest economy in Europe. So were the Germans to be pressured into cutting some of its ties and investment and trade relations with China, that's a good question. How would China react to that one? Because Germany, as do a lot of other modern Western countries, which we need to remember, despite the COVID and the economic downturn around the world, the Chinese economy is recovering, and trade between China and the United States and other Western powers has not gone down. It hasn't really gone down absolutely substantially. So what are the Europeans going to do about, we want humanitarian intervention, say in northwestern China with the Uyghur population, but then we don't want to lose money. We don't, because this trade supports our economic situation.
A lot of good points there, but one thing that I would note is that COVID did throw in several wild cards. One is the feelings of European publics regarding China, and there seems to be a very discernible souring of feeling about China in the COVID era. In addition to that, there's this sort of bigger question of what the EU sees itself as. And for a long time, it's been trying to transform itself into a foreign policy superpower. All sorts of different reasons it's never succeeded in doing that. But now there's this question of if the EU is going to survive and thrive, at least in certain respects, should it move further away from what has been its orientation of deepening the EU project, expanding the Eurozone, all those sorts of things, and shift to more of a foreign policy orientation? And if it does that, that may be bad news for Beijing, because particularly the human rights issues, I think, are a really hard sell for European publics. They do not like looking away from what is happening to the Uyghurs.
Does Europe itself, though, have certain divisions between particularly the Eastern and Western European countries that may very well make that a bit more complex?
Yes.
Absolutely. And it is quite possible that you are going to see EU countries going in different directions. And that already has happened. I mean, it's been happening for years. And I think it'll be difficult for the EU to really bring everybody together on side in a unified front. So, yeah, that the most likely scenario, at least for the short term, is European countries do what they want in regard to China and respond to their own public opinion, all that sort of thing.
So how would the United States play in this game? What type of policies might be best for the United States to pursue?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. We have a sense now that in the 90s and into the early 2000s, the United States elite, I don't know if how you want to call that, it's hard to identify such forces, loved free trade. That is to say that bring down tariff barriers to goods, especially to China, but we have to remember this applied to a lot of places, really, and by so doing, help those countries develop their economies, and eventually they will import some American and other Western goods. Well, it didn't work that way. That is to say that the tariff barriers were lowered, Chinese goods flooded into the United States, for example, and like I said, there's other countries involved in this one, but the imports of American products really didn't work out in the long run. Somewhat, but not quite so substantially as expected. And then, of course, this resulted, I mean, I'm not fully qualified to talk about it, in the loss of American jobs. And so the questions arose as to what can the United States do in a situation like that? I mean, should the United States become a sort of economically isolated pro-tariff country? And what is China? Is China a cooperative partner, as it was seen during the late 80s and into the 90s, or is this a serious competition? Could it even result in a military conflict?
I think those are all really good questions, and I would add into that this whole COVID issue of where the global economy is going is so central to everything, and yet we don't know what the answer is. And so there is, I think that certainly if you do read the financial press, there's a great deal of fear about what's going to happen in the next 6 months or more, where global markets are going. And honestly, unless and until there's more clarity on that, I don't think we're going to get real clarity about where the relationship between China, Europe, and the United States is going. But I do suspect that given all the things that have happened in the last couple of years, including China's foreign policy actions and its domestic actions against the Uyghurs, it's very hard for me to see a scenario where China receives the same level of cooperation in its efforts that it has had previously. Previously, particularly in a lot of European countries like Germany, the attitude was pretty common that, well, the Americans have a problem with China, but this isn't our problem. But now you have China has very explicitly said that it wants to dominate essentially every high-tech industry. And it is willing to play a very dodgy game in order to do that when it comes to trade regulations and stealing intellectual property and all sorts of stuff like that. So given all of that, I think that Europe, thinking about its own future, is increasingly worried about China's vision of its own future. That it's not just, oh, well, Taiwan isn't really our problem. That increasingly it's, well, okay, how does Europe fit into a world where China dominates robotics, the internet, genetics, you know, all sorts of the burgeoning areas?
That leads to some interesting questions in and of themselves, such as, what about potential alliances of various groups, not necessarily even with the United States, but other groups that the United States might want to work with in order to have greater control over the economics of the world?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think that in a lot of ways, Chinese decisions are mattering more than American decisions in that, as was just mentioned quite rightly by Brian, that there was this neoliberal consensus. It was often called the Washington Consensus. And this notion that free trade, a flat world, all those sorts of 1990s cliches were coming about. Oh, and democratization globally. That the age of the authoritarian governance was coming to an end. And all of those things have been completely blown out of the water. And so I think that China's own predatory practices probably matter more than anything in particular that the Americans are doing right now, and probably will for a while, because the Americans are essentially a neoliberal status quo power. They more or less, you know, although, you know, things were a little more confused in the Trump era, but they more or less like the system they created and want to keep it. But that system seems to be falling apart. I wouldn't be entirely surprised if the World Trade Organization pretty much collapses over the next couple of years. It's dangerously close now.
Well, interesting question, too, is how China sees itself as a model, particularly economically. China said in the last decade or so, that it was, well, it's been pushing this for a long time, that any country that is developing economically and wants to become a modern country, in the past, the United States has taken that lead as a model, but now China is suggesting that it's the best way to go. This is one of the things that's propelling China in its investment projects in Africa, for example. What is going to be happening as more and more of the world develops? Will democracy increase? Will democracy go by the wayside? Can an authoritarian government be modern? Those are interesting questions. So one of the questions that come up is, will Chinese Communist Party survive in the long run? Of course, the answer really is nobody knows, because the Chinese government doesn't release much information. Few people defect or talk about it. So we don't really know exactly what that is. It's possible, and there are some rumors about this, that when Xi Jinping came to power, there was real concern that the Communist Party is actually losing control and that the capitalist parts of the Chinese population, the go out and make as much money as you want attitude, was resulting in a lot of voices that said the government should step down from its influence in the economy and then its influence in other areas such as education. This may have been what prompted certain segments of the Communist Party to counter-react by appointing Xi as president. The idea was to make sure that the Communist Party held on to power. Could a second party emerge in China? Other independent parties? Well, at the moment, sort of, because the Chinese government can approve political parties, but only so much as those political parties follow along with government guidelines. So could something, if something like that were to happen, it might change the game, because then you might have competing approaches to economics and the economic development.
And that would be a very different trend line, and that seems to be what the Xi government is trying to absolutely prevent. I recently read a very interesting book called We Have Been Harmonized by a German author who was a reporter in China for many years and has a lot of good connections, and the degree to which the Chinese government is trying to create an absolute panopticon state. A state where the government, or particularly the Communist Party, really can see everything that goes on, can see everyone's activities. And they have made incredible progress toward doing that. And they have particularly caused a culture of fear within the Communist Party, and now I think increasingly probably within big business, having seen what happened to people like Jack Ma, where all of a sudden Jack Ma, who had been a sort of American-style or Western-style billionaire, you know, opinionated all over the media, sometimes even critical of his government in a cautious way, but not cautious enough. And so Ma has been sidelined, apparently, completely and isn't really running his own business anymore.
So based on what Dr. Arndt, you were saying, is it possible you're thinking of the maybe what happened in Poland in the late 70s, early 80s, with the existence of additional political parties under the communist regime, but that were effectively all tied. But when things started to collapse, they began to operate on their own.
Well, let's put that one to the test here. In a sense that China is still a Marxist country. All members of the Communist Party have more or less pledged allegiance to Karl Marx and Vladimir Lenin, and then Mao Zedong introduced his own brand of Chinese socialism, as he called it. Well, it was working party, is worker-centered. You know, that's an interesting question. We can put this one out there. Are the workers of the world dissatisfied with their lot these days? Can a modern capitalist economy really provide for the needs of its citizens enough? Now, in China, that's a really good question. You're seeing a transition in the workforce. If we go back into the 80s and 90s, the workforce came from the countryside. They sought opportunities, and they ended up in the big cities. And what they were involved in is construction and, of course, manufacturing in an enormous way. They were making very little money, although it was better than what they were learning back in their villages in the isolated area. So the question is the Chinese labor unsatisfied with its lot? Will it continue to be unsatisfied? But also there's a transition going on because the cheap labor is beginning to dry out. And as Dr. Walden mentioned, the technology industry is rising, which requires greater levels of education. The low-wage labor is being farmed out to neighboring countries. Vietnam is one of the best examples here. Well, the more education that's demanded for the Chinese workforce might perhaps require more Chinese students going abroad. And I've always wondered about this one because I've talked to Chinese students. Are they have complete access to the internet. They don't necessarily look into politics because that's so strongly discouraged. But what will happen in the long run? If you need a more educated workforce, will they be more interested in access to information outside of their own country? Now, I pose that one. What about Americans? Are Americans aware of what's going on in the world? Mm-hmm. Are American workers organized now? American workers back in the 1980s, they were a little bit worried. And in the 90s, they were very worried about that free trade issue. Well, what about in the world? What about in countries such as Japan, which has lost a lot of its labor force to age? So what about the future of the world in terms of its own workforce?
And I do think that is one of the big motives for Xi Jinping, is he sees that although they're now trying to boost the birth rate, having done a 180 on the former one-child policy, that he can see that there is going to be a decreasing population in China fairly quickly, and certainly an already quite aging population. That cheap workforce that was coming online in the 80s and 90s, most of those folks are approaching retirement age, and some have even passed it. Mm-hmm. So you really are seeing China trying to escape what's often called the middle income trap, mm-hmm. that China became a middle income country, mm-hmm. and it, like many middle income countries, it has pockets of great wealth. I mm-hmm. mean, if you look in mm-hmm. Shanghai, you'll see, mm-hmm. you know, fantastic wealth. Mm-hmm. But it also mm-hmm. still has a great deal of poverty, a great deal of underemployment. This has actually been a growing issue of college graduates unable to find work commensurate with their education. I mean, that just wasn't a problem in China 20 years ago, I don't mm-hmm. think. Mm-hmm. And so you add all of that up together, and there's a real question of how stable the communist system can be over the long term, the Communist Party single party rule. And I think that's the problem that Xi Jinping is trying to solve. That basically he is trying to create a panopticon state that's going to be the most powerful country in the world and that will be internally unified. He makes a big point about things like, forget the term, but it's something like something relating to history, historical nihilism or something like that, that if you mm-hmm. look at Communist Party history with too jaundiced an eye, mm-hmm. that will, you know, sort of, that's bad. That makes you, you know, not somebody who's trying to honestly examine the past, but that makes you somebody who's unpatriotic. And so I think he's trying to create essentially a form of totalitarianism that is, it combines elements of the old 20th century form, but with technological aspects that Stalin couldn't use mobile phones to track where everyone was going. But the other side of that is that most Chinese, I think the idea seems to be that most Chinese hopefully will be entirely content with the system, that they will be growing richer, that they will be feeling good about it. Now, whether that's actually the case, I think is eminently debatable, or if that's the system that I think Xi Jinping is trying to build. Now, you look at exceptions like the Uyghurs, and yeah, there are a lot of Uyghurs in an absolute sense, but in terms of the Chinese population, they're quite small. And so populations that are considered excessively troublesome, quote unquote, will be dealt with one way. And the great majority of Chinese citizens who are Han Chinese will be dealt with another way, as long as they don't make political trouble.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for enlightening us on these topics today. I really do appreciate it. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon.